Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive's Employee of the Month, 2 months in a row. Leave a message at the...
Hi, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. I just had a new idea for our song about the Name Your Price tool. So when it's like, tell us what you want to pay, hey, 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 and the trombone goes, blah, 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 and you say, we'll help you find coverage options to fit your budget. Then we just all do finger snaps while a choir goes, savings coming at ya, savings coming at ya. Yes? No? Maybe? Anyway, see you at practice tonight. I got new lyrics for the rap break.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, it's time for Bar None, a show that shines the spotlight on sports and activities to get you up and moving. I'm Audrey Raj, and today we begin with our power in the house for the week, fencing coach Nontapat Panchan from Blade Club KL.
Timing is huge. Timing and acceleration, that's probably a thing that I would say that make a really good fencer. But what I always tell people, the most important talent is actually none of those things.
Next, get on the ball and up to date as Frida Liu and I discuss the week that was in the world of sport. This week, we discuss politics in football and possibly the most embarrassing tackle in rugby history.
You know, we've had people biting ears off, so now we've moved the nether regions.
And finally, try a new activity this weekend. Angeline Tay speaks to Jason Voon on how you can start wakeboarding right here in the Klang Valley.
Can be quite painful, but not that painful, because you don't get really injured, like you don't twist your ankle a lot and you don't really slam on tar road or cement concrete.
BFM 89.9, it's Bar None. Today's power in the house is from Thailand, who is now based in Malaysia. He's Nontapat Panchan from Blade Fencing KL. A little about him, he was in the Thai national team for fencing and was 6 times a gold medalist at the SEA Games, took second place at 2004 Asian Fencing Championships, and represented Thailand in the 2008 Beijing Olympics. He has many more accolades, but we'll hear it directly from him. But first of all, Non, what brings you to Malaysia?
Well, actually, after 2008 Olympic, I retired from serious competitive fencing and I moved to Singapore. And after 2.5 years in Singapore with Blade Club Singapore, we always kind of look for a new direction, a new place to be. And we felt that Malaysia, the condition was right, and the trend of fencing was growing very, very fast. So that's what brought me here.
Right. And I have to ask this question. Why aren't you in Thailand?
Well, you know, I served as the member of the Thai national team for many, many years. And also, after I retired, the Fencing Association was interested into having me work with the national team, national coach position and such. And I kind of felt, you know, a bit uncomfortable, perhaps, maybe going back and not work with the national team right away. And also, I still want to grow and do my own thing and gather more experience before I go back there.
Right. I know that you started at the age of 9, but tell me, you know, how the fencing career evolved.
Well, it was more of an accident, actually. My mom, she used to work for the government, and of course, as we know, she got sick and tired of corruption after a while. So she was deciding to change her job to work with my father, who's a lawyer. And in order to do that, she has to go back to school. And of course, 3 children kind of have to keep the payroll going. So she went to night school at Thammasat University. Mm-hmm. And usually I would wait for her until she's done with her classes and all that. And of course, being a 9-year-old boy, quite naughty that I was just running around everywhere, causing so much trouble. So eventually my mom was, you know, all right, you got to find something for you to do. And while I was causing all this trouble, the fencing coach noticed me.
Okay.
And he sort of just gave me that first exposure to fencing.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he became my first coach and the man who started my career.
Right. And then after that, you were you moved to the U.S. when you were 13 and you continued with your high school and everything there. So, you know, tell us about that. How did that move to the U.S. happen?
Yes, it was, you know, it's supposed to be a short-term exchange thing, but suddenly turned to a long-term thing because I got on. I used to play basketball a lot, also actually, and I got along really well with the basketball program in high school. It was that they had excellent state championship program, so I felt it was a good opportunity to stay on. My parents thought it was good educational opportunity also. But the thing with fencing is actually quite a bit of an ordeal. Actually, when I moved to the States at first, I was in Florida, and there is no major fencing clubs in Florida. There are a few, but quite low level. And the closest fencing club was about an hour, hour and a half away driving on interstate. So it's quite far in that age. Of course, I couldn't just hop in the car and do it myself. So most of the time, for some reason, I just liked the sport so much and I just kept training by myself. And I did that for about a year and a half and, you know, went to local tournaments here and there and did fairly well. And after a year and a half of training alone in the basement, pretty much, just kept doing the same old stuff. I was like, all right, you know what? Let's try to go to one big tournament before I actually quit because it just seemed crazy.
Right.
So asked my parents, went to Texas, Dallas, actually, and joined under 17 years old North American Cup. I was about 15 years old then. And of course, as soon as I walked in, now it's like a North American Cup, you know, you see guys who are doing things I have never seen before. Oh. They're all decked out in professional gear. Like I have this set of like old rusted Chinese stuff, right? And I just look at people, I was like, oh my God, like 200 kids and their coaches were there. They just look extremely scary.
Okay.
Now they look like this guy really, I mean, they were doing stuff that I didn't even know existed in this sport, you know.
So sounds like a scene from Karate Kid. Anyway.
Pretty much, pretty much actually. And I competed that day, and of about 200 kids, I took third.
Oh.
And really based on very little that, you know, fencing technique that I knew that my old coach in Thailand taught me, but I just kept doing it, that I could do all those simple things so well. But and in all martial arts, really.
The basics.
The basic. The most awesome strike is the most simple strike. Right. And then the national coaches of the American junior and the senior team came over to me and said, congratulations, you beat a bunch of my students. Who are you? And I told them, like, I'm this Thai kid from Florida. And then, like, who's your coach? Like, I don't really have a coach. Like, where do you train? Mostly in my basement. And they were like, are you serious? You're crazy. We like you. Come up to New York.
Okay.
So that's when I moved to New York. And that's when I was really exposed to real high level fencing. And I mean, that training center, I mean, of course, most of the American national team members are from that club. And it was just, you know, just kind of springboard me to a next level from, you know, just regional level. And I mean, it went pretty much from more like number 100 something in the country to number 2 within 1 year in America for under 17 years old.
Right. So at that time, how old were you then when you moved to New York?
I was about 15, 16 at the time.
Okay. So, and, you know, when you think of fencing in the U.S., you don't think of fencing in the U.S., but apparently that's not the case.
Yes. Not just in the U.S., actually, fencing has enjoyed this global surge of popularity. I mean, we talk about fencing as a classical European sport, but now in Japan, you have thousands and thousands of fencers. Of course, China. I mean, take the biggest proof that now fencing is a global sport is the last Olympic Games in London in my category, foil. The first time, no European was on the podium. The first were Chinese, second were Egyptian, and third were Korean.
Right.
And that's kind of completely unheard of, because when you think about fencing superpower, you think about
the French.
France, Russian, Italian, you know, those classical Renaissance country. Yeah. And also, talking about America, last week the World Championship was in Hungary. In foil, an American won. Actually, my ex-teammate from New York won the World Championship. So I think a lot of technical sport like this, a lot of it is about knowledge. And, you know, with the world today, the barrier is down.
Okay.
There are many top coaches who move around and go to different countries. And, yeah, give that with a bit of time, you're going to see a surge of global skills coming up and just make the sport a lot more interesting, actually.
You just mentioned this category you're in, foil.
Yes.
And there are other categories, épée and saber. Tell us about that.
Okay, so there are three kind of weapons, foil, épée, and saber. The weapon itself look a bit different.
Okay.
They do different things, okay? So foil and épée it's a hitting weapon. When I say hit, I mean you hit with the tip.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas saber is a slashing weapon. And I'll go into a little bit of a history about it. The target area of foil is just the torso. No arms, no leg. Which make it a bit more technical because you get to really go in deep to hit someone. You can just, you know, hit on the leg or the limb
it's
and
more
score.
Technique. Yeah.
So it's more technical. It's the lightest and the fastest weapon in the term of hand speed. Why just the torso's target area? Foil was the weapon that the army used to train the soldier back in the day. Because when you go into a big battlefield, you want to hit where it hurts. You don't want to hit someone in the leg and he, you know, still coming at you. Right. And
you want to get to the heart.
Yes, exactly. You want to hit and stop the person.
Yeah.
That's why foil came about the way it is today. Epe is a dueling weapon. It's a bit bigger than foil. Still, you use the tip only to hit. And the target area is from head to toe. Epe developed from a dueling weapon. You know, back in the day, people, get into altercation with someone, I challenge you to a duel. And at one point, there were so many people dying because of it. So I'm not very sure which particular king or queen in England actually came up with the law. So you know what? You can duel, but you can only duel to first blood.
Right.
And that's why Epe came about the way it is. And whoever hit first wins, you know.
Okay.
And saber is a slashing weapon.
Mm.
And the target area for saber is from the waist up only.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is because most slashing weapon was used on a horseback.
I see.
So you know, when you're on a horseback, you're not going to go for someone's leg.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're mostly going to be from waist up only.
Right.
And that's the difference between...
With your school, you'd be teaching more foil.
Yes. Actually, at this moment, I only do foil. I believe in, you know... doing what you're good at.
Okay.
For the fencer, so.
But you personally like other sports like basketball and soccer.
Yes.
Yeah. And why did you decide to venture into fencing? Opportunity?
Not just that. I think it has a lot to do with character of the sport also. I played basketball since I was young, and that was actually one reason why I stayed on in the States. I also love martial arts, and I came from a family of boxers. You know,
of course.
On weekend, you know, they all get together, you know, watch the TV, and it's like, you know, everyone's really loud, that kind of family, you know. So I did a bit of boxing when I was younger also, different type of martial arts. So I actually really love martial arts. And fencing is one of those rare martial arts, actually, that you can go all out with someone all day long.
Mm-hmm.
And most likely, you're not going to draw that much blood.
Okay.
Or there might be no blood at all, actually. I'd rather say that.
Okay.
You know, in taekwondo or boxing or something like this, if you go hard at someone or you get hit very hard, it's going to cause injury.
Right.
When fencing, you can strike as hard as you can. And it's not much, just a pinch, really.
Right.
So it sort of creates that different environment of mental game.
Mm. Strategy.
A lot of strategy involved. So it's like really half muscle, half brain sort of sport. And I really, really enjoyed that aspect of the game. And I think that's what kept me on because it just created this crazy, intense mental game between the two opponents, you know. And you can check it out on YouTube now. Nowadays, there's everything on YouTube. You can see it's like a very intense battle. It's a short battle, but it's an intense battle.
Okay, what kind of training did you do previously when you were training for competitions?
We train when it was still at the professional level. We train about 6 hours a day, you know, 2 or 3 training sessions a day. All kind of stuff, actually, of course. There's a physical side of training, and there's like fencing side, the tactical side of fencing. Mm-hmm. On physical side, just almost like boxer, really. I mean, I would wake up and run about 1 hour every morning and then go do stadium work, plyometrics, a lot of plyometrics for.
What's plyometrics?
Plyometrics are simple term way to explain it. It's just agility training.
Oh, right.
A lot of jumping, step ladders, you know, like stadium run. Just a lot of jumping.
Okay.
Those kind of things. So plyometric, and then that's usually in the morning. And the afternoon, I'll be with my coach, work on my technique, maybe do one-on-one lesson, extra fencing footwork for speed and agility. And usually at night, we would spar for about 3 hours, two or 3 hours. So yeah, it adds up to about 6 hours.
Okay, so not much time for school.
And that's the thing that we sort of have to juggle also, and I guess my family has been pretty good with keeping me really scared about dropping my grades. Okay. So.
what strategy did they use? you fail, you quit.
I think my dad just being him is enough of a strategy.
All right, now how expensive is this sport, and is there a shelf life to this career? We'll ask our Power of the House today, and he's Nontapat Panchan right after this. Barnan, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to Banan, and I'm speaking to today's this week's Power in the House, and he's Nontapat Panchan from Blade Fencing, based out from KL, and with a name like that, he's originally from Thailand. We're talking about fencing and a little bit about him. He was with the Thai national team, 6 times a gold medalist at SEA Games, took second place at 2004 Asian Fencing Championships, and represented Thailand in the 2008 Beijing Olympics. Now, the impression that I get with this sport is that it's expensive. True or false?
False, okay. Actually. False, actually. Of course, it's not the cheapest sport in the world. But the idea that fencing is a high-class sport, expensive sport, is actually quite wrong. For example, some of the vendors, including my club, you can buy the whole set of fencing equipment for about 800 ringgit or less. And for a private lesson, each two-hour class, I think most of the club will charge only about, you know, six. In the range of 60 to 80 ringgit only. So if you compare it to 2 hours tennis lesson, golf lesson, or any kind of sport lesson, actually, 2 hours, you're probably going to end up paying quite a bit more. Right. And fencing equipment is one of those things that you can keep using for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. So a set might last you for 2 or 3 years. So I think if you look at the big picture, it's not an expensive sport at all. It's not. I think that, you know, because the classical connotation that come with the sport sort of give people this misunderstanding.
Yeah. It's how it's been showcased. So you have your school in Publica.
Yep.
Right, and it just started recently.
We started in February.
Okay, yes. And so like with you at your place, classes are how much per month?
If you train once a week, it's 240 for a month.
For an hour.
2 hours.
Two hours. Okay.
Fencing is one of those like muscle memory sport where every little fine detail counts. So to build that muscle memory and yet give you a good physical workout, I think an hour is really too short.
Okay. How long does it take for a person, let's not use me as an example, a normal person, to pick up the basics?
I would say the basics until you learn everything to the point where you're ready to gear up and actually go fence and battle someone. I would say 2 months.
Okay.
2 months to 3 months. I mean, that's quite early. And of course, nowadays, I teach a bit differently compared to people 50 years ago. When I started, I didn't even know how to hold a weapon for 5 months. First 5 months, I was just doing footwork every day. But that's like really old school. I'm not going to press anyone into the system. But yeah,
okay.
With our system of teaching, I think after 2 months, you can actually gear up and fence someone already.
When I get started, do I have to buy the gear or can I just get it on loan for the moment?
I don't know about other locations, but at my club, we actually provide all the gear at no additional cost at all.
Okay.
You can fence without gear forever. If you would like, we don't mind. But of course, fencing, there's a few items that are quite personal, like the mask, you know.
Right.
Your sweat is always better
your sweat
than other people's sweat.
Yeah. Now, is there a shelf life to this sport competitively? And I guess on a personal level, there's no shelf life, but competitively?
Competitively. Actually, fencing is one of those sports that you can stay competitive for quite a long time. I mean, I have a friend who no longer fences, but he took third place at the World Championship when he was 41 years old. Actually, there's a lady who made the 2008 Olympic Games, and she was actually almost in her 50s.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, Of course, you know, she was in amazing shape, and she actually used to fence for China before she started fencing for Canada. So she's a very good athlete, and she's a rare case. But let's go to show you that if you take care of your body well in this sport, you can go for a very long time, because experience and the mental strength and strategy also play a huge part in the game.
Mm. What sort of mental training did you go through?
Well, outside from fencing experience alone, and I would not restrict this to only fencing, you know, the modern science of sports psychology is extremely important. And actually, there was one of the big major factor in my career also. I went when it was about 19, 18, I sort of got stuck at this one level and I couldn't improve. Mm. Not because my skill wasn't improving, but because my mental strength wasn't there.
Mm.
And when you talk about strength, right, most people have this misconception of what strength should be. Strength is not hard. Strength shouldn't be brittle.
Mm.
And when people think about hardened character or hardened athlete, they're not flexible.
Mm.
You know, they just almost emotional and always look very, very tough, which is not true. I mean, if you look at the all-time greats in sport, for example, Roger Federer, Michael Jordan, these people are not exactly had the classical way of strength as we think of. They're extremely flexible. Mm. They could absorb all kind of emotion and situation that come at them. And that was a big turning point in my game when I learned that and know how to use it for myself. And it's actually a very, very big part of what I try to do, not only for myself, but my students, because these are the skills that these young kids or anyone at any age could use, not only in sport, but outside, in relationship, on the road, in traffic, you know, and anything really, the true mental strength. And that's what I enjoy doing, you know, with my job, is that I was able to communicate this idea and teach this thing, especially to people at young age, to really understand that what is that really mean to be tough, be tough the right way.
I think people sometimes think of sports, they think of Muhammad Ali, dance like a butterfly, sting like a bee. And, you know, they have this image of this, you know, this athlete or this powerhouse. But very interesting about how that strength actually comes from the mental strength as well. You know, and I guess in fencing as well, how do you know if someone has talent? What are you looking for when you say, this person's got it? Is it speed? Is it technique? What are you looking for?
Okay. Very, very good question, actually. In fencing and a lot of martial arts, actually, you mentioned something that people usually notice, but it's not very important, speed.
Mm-hmm.
To be fast, at least can say solidly in fencing, it's not always a good thing. To be explosive, to have acceleration, now that's good. Because if you fast, and you fast all the time, sooner or later, if your opponent is smart enough, they're going to recognize your speed and they can plan for your speed.
Right.
But if you can go sometimes slow, sometimes fast, and be able to accelerate on the spot,
mm-hmm.
now that's hard to defend against.
Right.
Right. And also another thing they're looking for is coordination.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have not so much coordination. Some people, they can pick up activity immediately, very, very fast because of coordination. They see it, their leg can do one thing, their arm can do one thing, and they usually learn the skill much, much faster. And when you have good coordination, usually you also have good timing.
Mm.
And in martial art, timing is huge. Timing and acceleration with good coordination, that's probably a thing that I would say that make a really good fencer. But what I always tell people, the most important talent, it's actually none of those things.
Mm.
It's work ethics.
Okay.
Absolutely. People don't think that work ethic is the...
It's important.
It's a talent.
Right.
You know, they think like, oh, you have talent, you know. If I see a kid who can't do anything, but he willing to stay after the class by himself in the corner, perfect that skill.
In the basement.
Sometime in the basement. I would tell immediately, that guy, now he has the most important talent.
Mm.
Because, as you know, hard work brings success.
Right.
And you see a lot of rabbit that doesn't get to the finish line, but many turtles, maybe not many, but few turtles,
okay.
You know, that made it. And to me, hard work is by far.
So with the school having started in February, how young can a person start fencing?
In the school and the club, we have a few mini fencers.
Mm-hmm.
They're about 6 years old. Actually, the youngest fencer in my club now, she's four, almost five.
Okay.
So munchkin little things, really. But in the beginning, with fencing, for very young kids, I don't focus on, you know, teaching the skills so they can battle each other.
Mm-hmm.
When you're young, the brain is still growing. There are certain things that a sport coach should be focusing on. To build, like I said, build coordination,
mm-hmm.
build a sense of timing. You know, this kind of thing, because in young kids, their brain is growing. If you activate those parts of the brain,
right.
they're just going to be a lot more of that. So I do a lot more like exercises and mm-hmm. game combined with fencing activity.
Mm-hmm.
So they develop those parts. Once they have those engine of, you know, acceleration, timing, sense of distance in them already, then later, extremely easy to make champion out of them.
Okay. Have you spotted any talents already?
Oh, yes. At the club, we have a few boys that it is a joy to work with them. Number one, they're great kids. They give me the reason to go to work and laugh uh-huh. every day. Sometimes yelling, sometimes laughing, but mostly laughing. We actually recently just came back from a tournament. We have a tournament in Bangkok last weekend, mm-hmm. under 17 years old tournament. And two of our boys, who are only 12 and 13, took second and third.
Right.
And yeah, and recently in at the Australian Open, the 12 years old boy, actually Hans, he for under 15 years old category, he took third place.
Mm.
So I think now at the club, now at Blade Fencing, we have a few little guys mm-hmm. that I felt that if they keep on with hard work and if they stay focused with the sport, they're definitely going to make Malaysia proud, not only at SEA Games level, but I think there are a few talents that if they stay focused, we can talk about on big medals and right. world championship and things like that.
And more guys, more boys than girls at the moment?
At this moment,
yeah.
It's just kind of a luck thing, actually. At this moment, I have more boys in my club, but in Singapore, yeah, 75% of my students were girls. Mm. So it could change in a few years. You okay. never know. You
we'll
never know.
See. We'll see. It's been a pleasure speaking to you. I've been speaking to Nontapapan Chan from Blade Fencing, and he's our power of the house this week. It's Bar None, BFM 89.9.
And that was this week's Power in the House, fencing coach Nontapat from Blade Club KL. Coming up, get on the ball and up to date on the week that was in sport. This is Bar None on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is Bar None and I'm Audrey Raj. It's now time for On The Ball. Frida Liu and I will fill you in on the week that was in the world of sport.
So what's your pick for this week, Audrey Raj?
Well, let's start with the ping pong game on the 2022 World Cup in Qatar, Frida. So here's some background on the World Cup bid. It was awarded to Qatar. They beat Australia, Japan, South Korea and the United States. But the problem is temperatures are expected to exceed 50 degrees Celsius. Like we've been talking about this for a while now, right? And organizers say they will use some high-tech cooling system to cool stadiums down as well as the game's village. But Sepp Blatter, FIFA president, he says you can do this, but you can't cool the entire country down, so they must now move it to winter, which will disrupt, you know, many football leagues in like England, France, Italy, Spain, Germany. So bad news.
Right. Okay, my question is, why bring this up now, like, you know, and not during the bid process?
Well, that's the question on everyone's mind, Frida. Now, I think to deflect the blame, Blatter now says that European politicians pressured FIFA members to vote for Qatar during the bidding process. Now, many think that this is just a dig at Michel Platini, who just recently said he could challenge Sepp Blatter for FIFA's top post soon.
Okay, why Platini? He is the UEFA president, right?
Yeah, well, but Platini is the only FIFA member to have confirmed that he voted for Qatar during the bid process. So he's always insisted, however, that he did so to take the World Cup to the Middle East for the first time. But there has been rumours that he was actually pressured by then-French President Nicolas Sarkozy in order to secure trade deals with Qatar.
So these are the rumors. Okay, so the conspiracy theories are out. So what can they do other than move the World Cup to winter? Can they award it to other cities that bid for the tournament now?
Well, that is not even on the cards, Frida. Well, Australia actually asked for compensation this week, some $43 million, the amount they spent to pitch for the World Cup, on news that they may now move the tournament to winter. But FIFA, of course, said no. They said the dates of the tournament are subject to change. You should have read the fine print, is what they said. So I guess the saga continues.
Okay, speaking of the World Cup, you said something about Singaporeans being caught for match fixing.
Yes. Police in Singapore have arrested 14 people, 12 men and 2 women, believed to be part of an organised crime gang involved in fixing matches in Europe, including World Cup qualifiers and Champions League games. Now, we're not sure if they are all Singaporeans. Talk of the town is that a number of them are Malaysians.
But the cops, I can place my bets on that.
And the cops say that they've nabbed the alleged mastermind behind this whole match-fixing process, but they did not reveal names. Now, shockingly, it involves like almost 700 matches, Frida.
The thing is, they're so organized.
They are.
They're so organized. We're talking, what, August, September? They're planning, man.
Well, we're talking about cheats
yet again.
Chris Horner apparently missed his dope test after winning the Tour of Spain on Sunday.
See, there you go. You see, maybe Lance Armstrong was right. Maybe all cyclists dope.
Well, this time it was not the rider's fault. Now, authorities turned up at the wrong hotel to carry out the test on Monday. I think they found it really suspicious that Horner won the race because he is the oldest ever winner of a Grand Tour. And that at the age of 41.
Young. Okay.
Anyway. 41 is young. But, you know, I place the blame on the US Anti-Doping Agency because they asked the Spanish authorities to test him for them. And then they gave the Spanish authorities the wrong hotel information. So Honor is not to blame for this. And you know what? He doesn't get tested.
Okay, so that's the kind of luck that eluded Armstrong, though.
Yes. And speaking of Armstrong, he has finally returned the Olympic medal he won in 2000 during the Sydney Games in 2000. So, finally. The IOC asked him for the medal back in January after his doping admission with Oprah Winfrey. He's finally returned the hardware.
Okay, so what next?
You know, every week there's definitely the oddball story of the week, something that shocks us at the news desk. This week, the Australian Rugby League, there's this player in the minor leagues, his name is Anthony Watts. Well, he's vowed to fight an 8-match ban for biting an opponent on the penis.
What?
Yes.
I was going to say, how did that happen? Anyway, what happened?
Well, these are just claims by his opponent. Apparently, it happened during a tackle in a minor league match. He used to play in the big leagues, you know, but he was dumped out due to disciplinary problems. It's about 2 years ago. But he says there's no way he bit the guy. Not there, not ever, because he was wearing a mouth guard. And he's come up with this conspiracy theory that it's just a way for the entire league to just eliminate him from rugby entirely. So... And you know what, Frida? It's quite disturbing because the alleged victim had to show match officials the mark on his manhood to lodge a formal complaint. So
this is
disturbing and shocking.
On his thingamajig. You know, we've had people biting ears off, so now we've moved.
Yes, and
the nether regions.
And this is what alarmed me because I was thinking Liverpool striker Luis Suarez, he got a 10-match ban for biting Branislav Ivanovic's hand. And this dude got an 8-match ban for allegedly biting his opponent's penis. So, getting back to that.
Right.
He's going to fight it because he says this is the kind of thing that overshadows your career. I agree with him. I think he should do whatever he can.
It's just wrong on so many counts. So finally, before we go, I'd like to remind everyone that this Sunday is World Car Free Day. So run or walk or bike this weekend if you can.
Yes, and if you're in KL, join a leisure ride around the city centre. The Malaysian National Cycling Federation is organising an event with DBKL, and there will be similar leisure rides taking place simultaneously throughout the world. So get on your bike. The route starts in front of the Dangwangi LRT station. It moves through Jalan Raja Chulan, and it will make its way through Jalan Ampang and back to Jalan Bukit Nanas. Grab your bike and make a day out of it. So that wraps up this week's On The Ball. Next up, Cause We Can. Stay tuned as Angeline Tay speaks to Jason Voon on how you can start wakeboarding this weekend. You're listening to Bar None with me, Audrey Raj. We are in our final segment, Because We Can, where we uncover community activities that might just be the one for you. This week, Angeline Tay speaks to Jason Voon on wakeboarding. You're listening to Because We Can with me, Angeline Tay. Well, it's a show to get us up on our feet and start moving. Wakeboarding is usually towed behind a motorboat at a speed of 30 to 40 km per hour. Similar to skateboarding, riders will perform tricks and stunts on a board on water. Well, today I have Jason Voon to tell us more about wakeboarding. Just tell me a bit about yourself, you know, how long have you been wakeboarding?
Well, I've been wakeboarding for around a year now. Started out last year without a board and I just got my board, so yeah. I'm very much serious into it right now. Yeah.
How did you get involved in wakeboarding?
Well, it started off around 15 years ago where I used to wakeboard. Not that often, but with friends. Just play around with my friends in the lake and it's more of a social thing, nothing serious. Then I stopped for quite a while and quite recently, I guess I wanted to get into the sport again. So I bought my own board and started wakeboarding. Yeah.
Is there any specific reason though why wakeboard?
Well, the story is that I used to have a skate shop. And I did, well, all my life I did extreme sports, from rollerblading to skateboarding to snowboarding and even to surfing. But I was primarily focused on my skateboarding and I did it for at least 15, 18 years. But then, you know, when age catches up with you, you tend to slam more and it hurts more and you know, the healing process takes longer. So I wanted something that would be much more easier and also still fun, still get that adrenaline and which without the pain, without so much pain.
Falling on water is less painful than falling on concrete.
It can be quite painful, but not that painful because you don't get really injured, like you don't twist your ankle a lot, and you don't really slam on tar road or cement concrete.
What kind of equipment is needed for wakeboarding?
Well, for wakeboarding, basically you need your board that fits your size and also the bindings that goes on the board. So the bindings is basically like bootleg where you fit your feet in and it's stuck to the board. Well, after that, well, you need a lake and a boat.
Whereabouts in Klang or KL you can go for wakeboarding?
Okay, there's two places that you can actually can go wakeboarding. One is in Putrajaya and another one is in Mainz Wonderland.
Is it calm water is better or the waves is better for wakeboarding?
Well, calm water is much, much better so that you don't work out too much of your thighs and your knees. Because when the water is choppy, you tend to absorb a lot of the impact on your knees and also on your thighs. So yeah, calm water is much better. And when you go wakeboarding, the best times to go is usually in the morning. That's where the water is really, really calm.
Right.
Yeah.
Any of proudest stunt that you can do? Any flips?
Well, not yet. I'm now practicing my wake-to-wake jumps and yeah, progressing. But I'm really psyched to actually do my first tantrum.
Call that tantrum.
Tantrum is basically a flip over. You go 360, but vertical.
Vertical
360. Yeah, instead of a 360 spin. Yeah.
Can anybody just wakeboard?
Yes, anyone who, you don't need to swim to wakeboard because you have your life jacket on. So anyone, practically anyone can wakeboard.
Is it safe for a kid?
Yeah, it is safe for a kid. Any kid who can, you know, grab on to the handle, probably around 4 years old onwards, yeah.
Wow. What are the skills or training is needed for wakeboarding?
Well, determination.
Determination.
Yeah, a good sense of balance. Not much skill. Just balance. Knowing how to flip, having that center of gravity, is important. Yeah.
What are some of the hardest part of this sport?
You have two parts of wakeboarding. One is behind the boat. One is cable park. Unfortunately, we don't have a cable park in Malaysia just yet.
Mm.
So I hope there'll be a cable park soon. So the cable park works as you go around the lake without a boat. So there's winches that would actually bring you around the lake. And basically, within those lakes, you have different obstacles, whether it's a jump ramp or a fun box. A fun box is basically a grind box. And that's where you take your skill to the next level. Just like a skateboarding park, you have lots of obstacles. Mm-hmm. So you can attack those obstacles together with your board on a cable park. And that's where you learn how to grind and you know, get off the ramp and start doing your stunts on a much more higher level.
Mm.
Yeah.
So is there any wakeboarding club?
Not that I know of. We're a small bunch of people, but basically we're all quite close. Once we get to know there's other wakeboarders, we'll just tend to hang out a lot more. It's a growing sport, but there are a few Facebook pages out there that has, you know, a small community. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you happen to know the name of the Facebook page?
Well, I own one. it's called Wakeboarding Malaysia on Facebook. Where
okay.
It's just a bunch of my friends coming together, you know, discussing when to go wakeboard next time, discussing what tricks, their own tricks and skills, how to level up their skills. And, you know, one thing about wakeboarding, it brings a lot of friends and family together. We don't just have to wakeboard, you know, you can sit around, have barbecue, have a few drinks, enjoy company.
So if I want to go wakeboarding this Saturday, I'll just go on a Facebook page and say, hey, I want to join, when are you guys going, can I tag along? Yeah?
Yeah?
Does that work?
Yeah, that will work.
Well, thank you, Jason. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And this is Because We Can, so go on a lake and start wakeboarding.
And that's all for Bar None this week. If you're passionate about sports or activities and want to share that excitement with us, email us at barnone@bfm.my. You can also follow us on Facebook by liking our page, facebook.com/bfmbarnone. Thank you for listening, BFM 89.9.
Now's the time to find your color, your paint, and everything to get started during Red, White, and Blue Savings at the Home Depot. Transforming your room is easier than ever. With the best deals online and in-store, you can confidently select your color and the tools for your next paint project. Get a colorful new experience and the right paint for the right price. Save $10 on 1 gallon and $40 off 3 and 5 gallons for a limited time only at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Limit 25 gallons per household. See store for details.